From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. Arun Roth is away. I'm Tess Vigeland. In this episode, undocumented immigrants face the realities of a new policy.
You're happy because you know you're going to qualify, but you're miserable because you know so many of your friends and family members are not going to.
A new technology to reduce G-forces inside helmets could tamp down on concussions in football.
What the magnets would do is really introduce a break on the system before the collision takes place.
And if you're giving an iconic doll a job in computer programming, you'd best avoid stereotyping her.
Whether or not Barbie wants to be a role model, she's in that position.
Plus, British folk rockers Teddy and Richard Thompson knit together a reunion album.
The musical family heirloom sweater. It smells funny, but it's got a lot of personality.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. Yeah, you were always down for it. Get in this getaway and we run from it. You're giving me the coldest stare, like you don't even know. Arlette Pichardo was also watching the president's action closely this week. She's 25 years old and a student at UCLA. Almost 20 years ago, Pichardo immigrated to the U.S. from Mexico with her parents. The family had a visa at the time, but it has long since expired. Pichardo's mom had two more kids after arriving in the U.S., so they are American citizens. When President Obama enacted DACA 2 years ago, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, Pichardo qualified, and she is now one of the immigrants known as Dreamers. The president's announcement Thursday means her mom can also now stay in the country without fear of deportation. I asked Pichardo what it was like to watch the speech.
You know, to be honest with you, it was very nerve-wracking, a lot of mixed emotions the whole day. I mean, I went to go see my therapist that day. That's how intense it was, because it was really nerve-wracking.
Why? Well, how so?
Well, you know, it just took me back to 2 years ago when he made his first announcement. It's like, you're happy because you know you're going to qualify, but you're miserable because you know so many of your friends and family members are not going to. So it's that bittersweet feeling.
Arlette, I understand you spoke to your mom right after the speech. What was that conversation like?
I was like in tears. You know, it was just so many mixed emotions, feeling that finally after 20 years of living here, you know, my mom was going to be protected, you know, at least. And, you know, we won't have that fear of being separated. So I was a hot mess. Like, I was crying. You know, I had the boogers rolling. It was dramatic.
Was she crying?
No, she was fine. She was like, you know, it was about time this happened. So, of course, she's relieved. And, of course, you know, it takes a little bit of weight off your back. But, you know, she's very critical too and very analytical, and she's like, you know, this is not the answer to the immigration problem we have. This is not going to solve the problem of 12 million people undocumented, you know.
Arlette, there are certainly members of your community, people who are not authorized to stay in the country, who will not be covered by the president's order. Do you feel any sense of, for lack of a better word, guilt, as your family has an opportunity when others don't?
Of course. I mean, I live with five people. One of my roommates, he was born here, so he's a U.S. citizen, so no concern. Then there's four of us who are undocumented, but all four of us qualified for the first DACA, which was the students, the Dreamers. But out of us four, only two of us have parents who are going to qualify because we have younger siblings who are born here. The other two, unfortunately, don't have any brothers and sisters who were born here, so their parents don't qualify. And it's just devastating. Like, I heard some of those calls where they had to make to tell their parents, like, you don't qualify. And it's just, like, so heartbreaking. You know, they're still going to live with that fear. They're still not going to qualify for health care reform. You know, they're still going to be dehumanized. They're still going to continue to be persecuted and be second-class citizens. And it's just horrible.
Well, as you know, there are no guarantees with this executive action. In a couple of years, another president could come in and reverse the policy. So as you think about your family's situation, how do you weigh that possibility?
You know, I feel like something people don't understand is I have lived undocumented in this country for 19 years. I've only been documented for 1 year. If they take it back, I wouldn't be, like, it wouldn't be the end of the world. Does that make sense? Like, the percentage of my life that I've actually been documented has been, like, 0.01, you know, in comparison to the rest of my life. So it's like you can't take something away from me that you really didn't give me, because they didn't give me a pathway to legalization. They just gave me a Band-Aid.
Arlette Pichardo, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Our collective image of the U.S.-Mexico border likely consists of a fence and desolation on either side of it. But that nearly 2,000-mile stretch of land also holds a surprising amount of ephemera, and photographer Richard Mizrach spent the last 5 years documenting it. After the journey, he asked composer Guillermo Galindo to build instruments out of those objects and to create music from them that sounds just like the desolate landscapes captured in his stunning photographs. I asked Mizrach what sorts of things he comes across along the border.
Backpacks and water bottles, tennis shoes, things like that. Each one of those objects has this incredible story, and it's a tragedy. Every single one of them is a tragedy. I mean, tennis shoes of a four-year-old, two of them, just sitting there without the child in them. What does that mean? Why is just the shoes there? Hmm. I get those and bring them back to Guillermo so he can incorporate them into his instruments.
All right. Well, Guillermo, tell us about some of these instruments that you designed.
Lately, I've been using objects from the Border Patrol or parts of the wall.
Parts of the actual border fence.
Yeah.
What did you turn that into?
Well, there's one that it's a piece of iron. I made this metallic harp. There's also a shell piñata that is made out of empty shells of the rifles of the Border Patrol. Hmm. And it's in the shape of a piñata.
Well, you call one of these instruments an effigy, and it really does resemble a person, or at the very least, a scarecrow. Tell us about the design of that and what it's made from.
It's a dress with clothing from the immigrants. It contains strings in the chest and in the arms that stretch really long, so they produce really low tones. And inside the skeleton of it is hollow wood.
All right, let's hear what the effigy sounds like. Richard, do you find these effigies as they are, or is that something that you constructed for the photograph?
No, everything that I photograph, I find in the landscape.
So what would have been the purpose of those?
That's a good question. In 2009, when I found them, there were just maybe 15 to 20 of them along the border in remote desert canyons, things like that. And I didn't know whether this was an art project by somebody or a warning to immigrants coming over the mountain passes, or perhaps even protests against the Border Patrol. Hmm. Part of what I found so amazing about them is that they were so enigmatic and mysterious.
Then there's also the crank drum, and this is quite the instrument. A shoe, a glove, cranked down to hit a drum made of a tire and rawhide skin. Guillermo, how did you design that?
Well, it's based in Leonardo da Vinci, a mechanical device named the Martello. The whole thing is a crank machine, and it has a donkey jaw, a horn that act as stoppers of these gears that are made of the shape of the Border Patrol targets. And this activates both a shoe and a glove. As you crank it, they play the drum.
Now, the San Jose Museum of Art will be exhibiting your photographs along with Guillermo's music in 2016, and then it's going on a national tour. What happens to all these objects after that ends?
We figure it's going to probably travel for 3 years, and after that, I imagine they'll end up in institutions to be preserved and to continue to be thought about, but we don't know. What do you think, Guillermo?
Yeah. They have to be kept. They're very important. Mm-hmm. This is not trash, and this is not a recycling project. No, these are sacred objects, literally.
Richard Mizrach, Guillermo Galindo, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
to see Ms. Rack's photos and Galindo's instruments, visit our website at npr.org. Ferguson, Missouri continues to watch and wait as a grand jury decides whether to indict police officer Darren Wilson in the killing of 18-year-old Michael Brown. Brown's death was the spark for protests in Ferguson, but many African Americans from the city say the problems go deeper and that they are unfairly singled out by police. And FBI statistics show the department in Ferguson does arrest African Americans at a higher rate than other racial groups. But that disparity is true for police departments across the country. Brad Heath is an investigative reporter with USA Today, and in a story this week, he wrote that the most remarkable thing about Ferguson's arrest record might be just how ordinary it is.
Nationally, it turns out that black people are arrested at a rate about three times higher than people of any other race. And that's pretty much what you find in Ferguson. But if you look at the geography of those inequities, there are a lot of cities where the disparity is, you know, five times higher, 10 times higher, even 20 times higher.
Well, in fact, one of the examples that you point to is Dearborn, Michigan. 4% of that city's population is black, yet more than 50% of the people arrested were black.
That's right. I mean, Dearborn's an interesting city. It's a mostly white city, although the white population includes a huge Arab immigrant population. And it's sort of tucked into the southwest corner of Detroit, which is the poorest and blackest of America's major cities. I went and spent the morning at district court a couple weeks ago, and almost everybody waiting in line to come into the court to answer for these petty criminal offenses was black. And they all, it dawned on a lot of them that they don't look like the city in which they were arrested.
Well, in fact, you did ask the police chief to respond to what you found. What did he tell you?
He said a couple things that were interesting. One was, which I think is true, a lot of the people his officers arrest don't live in the city of Dearborn, so it's hard to judge them just by the demographics of that particular city, because they do get a lot of people driving through from Detroit on their way to work. They do have a large shopping mall and a large retail presence. So you see a lot of people who wouldn't be counted in the resident population. And the other thing that he pointed out was a lot of the arrests his officers make are initiated by somebody else. It'll be a mall security guard or somebody who detains somebody for shoplifting or suspects them of something else, and his officers show up and just arrest whoever security has picked out already. But he does acknowledge the sort of accumulated mistrust that comes from having everybody standing in line at the courthouse not look like the city, and it's become a really interesting challenge for them to try to solve.
Well, of course, Brad, the biggest question all this raises is why? Why are police arresting African Americans at such higher rates than any other group?
That turns out to be a really hard question to answer. I mean, we talked to a lot of experts in profiling and policing and a lot of police chiefs and officers, and they say it certainly points out the possibility of law enforcement bias, but it also points out that this could be a function of disparities in economic outcomes, in education, in poverty, in all sorts of other social variables that are really hard to measure and really hard to correlate. So what you're left with is, you don't know exactly what's causing these numbers to be so different. But what you do know is, to go back to that experience in a Dearborn courtroom, that when people look around the benches to see who's waiting to be arraigned, they realize that there is this disparity, and most of the police chiefs I talked to were pretty concerned about the fact that it exists and, what can we figure out why it exists so that we can do something about it so that the communities we're trying to police will trust us.
Brad Heath is an investigative reporter with USA Today. Brad, thank you.
My pleasure.
Women in the technology field have faced all manner of insults, including, most recently, Gamergate, which highlighted sexism and harassment in video game culture. This week, the insult came from a seemingly more benign source, but one that set off a loud online cry of, "Are you kidding me?" A book called Barbie, I Can Be a Computer Engineer was originally published in 2010, but this week, author and Disney screenwriter Pamela Ribbon took to her website to excoriate some glaring stereotypes in the book, which she only came across just recently.
I was at my friend Helen Jane's house, and I found this book on her table. I said, "Oh, this is so exciting! Barbie, I can be a computer engineer!" Like, this is very exciting. And she said, "Oh, now I'm really going to break your soul."
So Pamela Ribbon started reading.
It starts so promising. Barbie's designing a game to show kids how computers work. This is for school. She's going to make a robot puppy do cute tricks by matching up colored blocks. Skipper asks if she can play the game, and Barbie says, "I'm only creating the design ideas," Barbie says, laughing. "I'll need Steven and Brian's help to turn it into a real game."
Barbie gets a virus on the computer, which then infects another computer, and oh dear.
So then she asks some boys to fix it for her, and they say, "It'll go faster if Brian and I help," offers Steven.
At the end of the day, Barbie takes credit for the boys' work. Ribbon was ticked off. She wrote about it on her blog on Monday. The tech blog Gizmodo picked it up, and by Tuesday, it had gone viral.
Everybody was just enraged with me, which was so nice. From the very beginning, it was, "I hear you, I support you," men and women across the board. People were upset for their daughters and their sons in schools. And, you know, whether or not Barbie wants to be a role model, she's in that position.
Midweek, Mattel issued an apology on the official Barbie Facebook page, saying, quote, "The portrayal of Barbie in this specific story does not reflect the brand's vision for what Barbie stands for." Writer Pamela Ribbon thinks that's a good first step, but she's been more impressed by how people online have responded.
I mean, give the internet a problem, it'll fix it with a lot of flair. People on the internet have made hundreds of different versions of this book now because of Feminist Hacker Barbie's site.
That site, Feminist Hacker Barbie, was created by Kathleen Toot, a computer scientist in Santa Cruz, California.
So one of my friends posted this call to action on Facebook that was like, "Hey, other lady programmer friends, can we crowdsource some feminist slash hacker text to paste over the originals?" And I was like, I do a lot of crowdsourcing app design. Maybe I can make this up.
She put together a website that allows users to write their own text for the illustrations in the Barbie book.
One of the very first ones that came in was basically a role reversal. Instead of Barbie as the game designer, she was the game programmer. It says, "Barbie worked hard to implement Steven and Brian's gameplay designs. Although she enjoys writing the code to bring these designs to life, she also respects the knowledge of user experience that designers like Brian can bring to the table."
Kathleen Toot says she's gotten more than 2,000 submissions.
These improved revisions that we're seeing now actually give a better sense of what it's like to be an engineer.
Across the country, another woman in the computer science field was also getting fired up about the Barbie book. Casey Fiesler is a PhD student at Georgia Tech.
Well, originally when I saw this story, I thought, you know what is great about this, though, is that obviously what's going to happen is someone's going to write a new book or it's going to become a meme or something like that. And I thought I should actually just do it myself.
Fiesler got to work in Photoshop and rewrote the entire book so that instead of the computer virus being the big problem, Barbie is upset about something else.
I thought, well, maybe she's upset about sexism in computing. So she is making a game, and she's making a game in collaboration with the boys. And she says that when she posted about her game on Twitter, people assumed that she must be the designer, but boys were doing the coding.
So in Fiesler's story, one of the boys is the designer and Barbie is the coder. Fiesler says the response has been overwhelmingly positive.
And I've had people tweeting at me and leaving comments saying that they printed it out and read it to their kids, that their daughters were so excited and they want to be computer scientists. I've had people ask me if they can translate it into other languages.
One part of this story, though, has gotten ugly. The woman who wrote the original book for Mattel told ABC News that she's gotten hundreds of nasty emails and is scared to open many of them. She told ABC that she regrets that she may have let stereotypes slip into the book. Earlier this week, Mattel and publisher Random House pulled the book from Amazon and announced that the print and ebook publication will be discontinued. You remember toying around with magnets when you were a kid, right? If you try to push two sides with the same charge together, they put up a fight. Well, Raymond Colello wants to put those forces to use in football helmets. Colello is a researcher at Virginia Commonwealth University, and he's a football fan, and he knows that there is only so much that traditional helmets can do to stem concussions on the field. So one day, about a year ago, as he was watching a Denver Broncos game, he had a classic aha moment in the wake of a big hit on star receiver Wes Welker.
You know, at that point, I was thinking, wow, they really need a force field around their heads of some sort. And at that time, I walked back to my refrigerator for maybe one more drink, and I happened to see the refrigerator door, and on top of it was a lot of the art of my children. All of a sudden, it came to me.
All right. Well, explain how this might work.
What the magnets would do is really introduce a brake on the system before the collision takes place. You know, very similar to, imagine a guy driving a car running into a wall 30 miles an hour. He's going to expose himself to a certain amount of impact forces. Well, imagine that same gentleman driving his car 30 miles an hour into a wall, but just before he hits it, he jams on the brakes. He's still going to hit the wall, but it's going to stretch out the time in which the collision occurs. And that's where we're going to get a real change in G-forces that his body will experience.
I know the fluid around the brain protects it from a certain amount of jostling. The helmet, of course, protects it even further. But what have you found in your experiments with magnetized helmets?
First of all, you know, when you think about the players that play, for example, Chris Johnson.
One of the faster players in the NFL.
One of the fastest runners. You know, he can run up to 20 miles an hour. And if he gets hit in the open playing field, the forces are quite staggering. And what we're talking about is a change of acceleration. The impact time will take only 12 milliseconds, and he'll experience 120 Gs of force. Now, if you can actually extend that time to, say, 17 milliseconds, you can shift the G-forces down to 88. We're not going to be able to change his velocity. He's going as fast as he can go, but we might be able to extend the time in which that impact takes place. Well, what we found in laboratory experiments, a 60G impact would be shifted down to about 20, 25 Gs. An 80G impact would be shifted down to about 40, 45. And 120G impact, which is concussions readily occur at 100 Gs, 120 impact, would be shifted down to about 88 Gs.
You know, magnets are used in medicine for imaging all the time. But I wonder if there's any other existing technology that will tell you whether it's okay for people to put magnets this close to their skulls for three or more hours at a time.
You're absolutely right. I think our closest analogy really we have is MRIs. Mm-hmm. These magnets that we have are producing field strengths that are only 2% or 1% of what you would see if you're exposed to a magnet in an MRI.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, it sounds like you're pretty early in the research stage here. What happens next?
We're trying to make a specific type of magnet that would be arc in nature so that it would fit right within the inside of the polycarbonate shell of the helmet. And these have to be specially designed and manufactured. What we're doing then is we're going to be using the Hybrid 2 head forms that normally you've seen in crash test dummies. They have accelerometers placed within the head. In fact, we're going to be using a zip line to run two helmets towards each other and then getting that data to determine what kind of forces have been reduced or how the forces have changed upon impact. Once we get that data, then we'll know when and how to proceed to field conditions.
Raymond Colello is an associate professor of anatomy and neurobiology at Virginia Commonwealth University. Thank you. It's fascinating.
Well, thank you, Tess. Really appreciate it.
I'm walking on a wire. I'm walking on a wire. And I'm falling.
In 1982, the beloved British folk duo Richard and Linda Thompson split up, both creatively and romantically. Ever since, fans have longed for their reunion. One fan in particular, their son Teddy. Teddy was just a boy back then. Now he is 38 with a recording career of his own. And Teddy has done something kind of incredible. He brought together about a dozen musical members of the extended Thompson clan, including Richard and Linda, for a new album called Family. I spoke with both Richard and Teddy about the project, which turned out to be slightly more complex than any of them had expected. Here's Teddy.
At the time, I thought it would be sort of easy, if you will. I thought we'd only have to write two songs each. I thought that'll be quick and easy.
Something like this had sort of dimly occurred to me over the years, but I thought, well, it's impossible. It can't be done. It's impractical. No one would ever come up with an idea like
that. No one would be foolish enough to attempt.
Exactly, yeah. But I think technology was a great help in doing this. The fact that we could do stuff in our little home studios and then send stuff around. Couldn't have done that really a few years ago. And it's turned out great.
Here you are, my bonny boys. You're all dressed up
to seize the world and all its toys.
Every voice, every instrument here is played by a Thompson relative, either a blood relative or someone who married into the family. Is this a requirement if someone marries one of you that they have to be able to sing or play an instrument?
It helps.
Yeah. It just seems to happen anyway, you know. I suppose if you're a family of plumbers, you know, you tend to marry other plumbers, you know, so it's the same.
No, you don't.
Don't you?
It's a great example.
I'm sorry, I don't actually know any plumbers.
Well, Teddy, you have said that your therapist had a field day with this idea. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't want to get all into... why not? Let's have a therapy session.
Yeah, why not?
In retrospect, there was definitely something about the fact that I was trying to sort of knit my family together, albeit musically. And I was blissfully unaware that there was any sort of connection. I just mentioned it one day and he was flabbergasted that I hadn't sort of realized what I was doing, you know.
So it's like an enormous cardigan, you know, with sort of 8 holes for heads you knit everybody into.
Yes, a musical sweater.
Musical sweater,
if you will. A musical family heirloom sweater. It smells funny.
It's very nice. Yeah.
But it's got a lot of personality. That's how we'd like you to think of the album.
You know, speaking of this family dynamic, Teddy, I would love for you to share what you said in the liner notes about what it was like to have control over all kinds of family members and what they sounded like.
Yeah, well, I think what I said was that there's nothing so satisfying as erasing your parents,
right.
Which, how's that for an Oedipal moment? I don't want to sound like I'm ganging up on you, Dad, or making you pay for, you know, childhood traumas or anything. But, you know, it's when I was a kid and it was, you know, you feel sort of out of control, I think, is the overwhelming feeling, you know, when your parents split up. So there was something about being in control of this, which was enormously satisfying.
Yeah, but Teddy, it's over now. The record's finished.
No, I'm carrying it forward. This is the way I'm going to operate from here on out.
We're going back to normal now.
No.
Well, Teddy, the first song on the record is one of yours, and it's clearly a mission statement for the album, maybe even a therapy session itself.
My father is one of the greats to ever step on a stage. My mother has the most beautiful voice in the world. And I am betwixt and between. Sean Lennon, you know what I mean. Born to the manor and never quite clamoring free.
Richard, as Teddy's dad, when you hear this song, what goes through your mind?
It's a little close to the bone in some way, mm-hmm. So... I'm slightly taken aback by the song, in a good way.
Aback in a good way. What do you mean?
Well, I'm not always ready for a song that kind of tells it like it is, if you like. Sometimes songs have veils over them, you know. But this song really is about family reality, and it's okay because it's a well-constructed song. It's a good piece of craftsmanship. I can get used to that.
My grandmother gave me all of the love that she had. She lived for us kids, but never a thought for herself. But she never dealt with her pain, and I've done exactly the same. Pushing it down or trying to drown it away.
To be clear, this is not a Richard and Linda Thompson a creative reunion. As far as I can tell, only one song features the talents of both, and it's That's Enough. Richard, was that a conscious decision? Let's not make this a perceived reunion album?
No, it wasn't a conscious decision, but people sometimes have that expectation, and I don't think that's something that we want to do. We don't want to perform again together. But Linda has a lot of problems with her voice anyway, and I think that really nips it in the bud. But people should not have that expectation.
Richard, this all has to be pretty amazing for you. I mean, what's it like to hear these generations of Thompsons all together on one album?
Well, it's great. I'm very proud of my children and grandchildren. I think it's fantastic that they chose not to go into banking and accountancy, as I was hoping they would. They went into the family business instead. They went into music, which is, as we know, it's a hit and miss profession. I'm sincerely glad that they have, because they have the talent to do it. And to hear the family harmonizing or something, it's just such a fantastic feeling. It's wonderful.
That's Teddy and Richard Thompson. Together with many members of the Thompson family, they've released a new album called Family. It's been great to have two elements of that family with us. Teddy, Richard, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Times are tough, times are tough. That's enough, that's enough.
You know Jeff Bridges, the actor.
Don't believe in fairy tales or sermons or stories about money, baby sister, but thanks for the cigarette.
When you ride with me, you ride with the best. The pace is lightning. Things are going to come at you fast. They're going to come hot.
Yeah, well, the dude abides.
Well, he's also got a band. They go by Jeff Bridges and the Abiders. Yes, a nod to the dude in The Big Lebowski. As NPR's Daniel Hajek reports, the Abiders are on tour this month, playing songs from their new album live.
On stage, he's unmistakable. A button-down shirt, sleeves rolled up, long hair slicked back, and a beard. Strumming a ruby red guitar, Jeff Bridges is as laid back as you'd expect up there.
Feels like flying for a little while. It's funny how falling feels like flying for a little while.
I got to talk to Bridges when he stopped in at NPR West the night before a show. Do people find it surprising when they find out that you have your own band?
Not too surprising. Occasionally you get somebody said, "Oh, I didn't know you did that," you know.
This is more than just a side gig for him. Bridges already has two albums out. He says he's always strumming his guitar, even when he's on a movie set.
You know, whenever I'm working, I'll always have my guitar with me. And if there's a nice tree to sit by, or a little creek or something, I'll go out there. And anywhere's a good place to play music.
To Bridges, it's just like everything else. It's cool.
Yeah, yeah. Going on 65. And I'm living this wild teenage dream, and it's so bizarre.
I don't know, baby, where we stand. Where's the future that we planned so long ago? Baby, I don't know.
This song off the new album is titled I Don't Know. It's from the 2009 film Crazy Heart.
I'm Bad Blake. Wasn't born bad. When I die, my tombstone will have my real name on it. Until then, I'm just going to stay bad.
Bridges' Oscar-winning portrayal of a fading country music singer brought his songwriting talents into the spotlight.
Yeah.
But his singing debut, that happened long before then. Remember that black-and-white TV show, Sea Hunt, starring his dad, Lloyd Bridges?
I was unaware that my presence underwater was of great interest to a couple of people on the surface.
Do you see him?
I see his air bubbles.
As a kid, Jeff appeared in several episodes.
At the time, my girlfriend, when I must have been 7, 8 years old, Andy Kaplan, my next door neighbor, my dad got us both to do this Sea Hunt episode.
I'm scared. Oh, don't cry. Please listen.
And it required us to be trapped in a cave, and I sing, I think, Oh Susanna.
Oh Susanna, oh don't you cry for me.
Maybe if we sing, they'll find us.
Music goes all the way back then.
Yeah, man.
As a teenager, he played all throughout high school. He didn't want to follow his dad's footsteps as an actor. He wanted to play music.
You got no man's legs, dude.
This recording was made back in the early 80s in a rundown art studio here in L.A. It was rented out by a friend of Bridges named Stephen Bain.
What a wild time that was.
BAME says there was only one rule. No cover songs allowed. Everything had to be original.
We made Wednesday night the night. And so every Wednesday night for like 10 years, people would gather in the studio.
Bridges says it was the spot to play.
We had a place, man. You know, it was like playing cards, but instead of playing cards, we played music. And he recorded everything we did.
Hours of strange, psychedelic recordings, old cassette tapes that have been stored away for years. Bridges says they still get together to play.
Occasionally, we'll say, you know, come on, let's Wednesday night jam it, guys.
Just like old times.
That's right.
On stage with the Abiders, it's toned down a little. Bridges plays more country and rock and roll. And it's just his style.
Okay, you guys said.
This was a couple weeks ago at the historic Saban Theater in Beverly Hills. Between songs, he mingles with the band and casually chats with the crowd, just like he's playing for a group of friends. And there's every kind of Jeff Bridges fan in the audience. Mike Bargeron and Keith Famulero are at the lobby bar, sipping cocktails on special tonight.
We got some White Russians here.
For the dude.
Drink of choice.
Exactly.
This music thing seems to fit Bridges pretty well. After a while, you think it's actually the dude up there, playing through the song What a Little Bit of Love Can Do. It's just Jeff Bridges having a good time.
Oh, man, this is so cool. And being as old as I am and have written so long and, you know, accumulated so many different songs that I want to realize, that's kind of an interesting combination there.
It's comforting sitting here listening to his music. As the stranger Sam Elliott said at the end of The Big Lebowski,
it's good knowing he's out there, the dude, taking her easy for all this sinner.
Yeah. Daniel Hajek, NPR News.
The HBO series Getting On is now in its second season. The show is set in the geriatric ward of a hospital and takes viewers inside every aspect of life with the elderly patients.
Bend over, lean forward just a little bit. Okay.
The show is based on a British series by the same name. The HBO version premiered last year and started with Nurse Dee Dee, played by Niecy Nash, getting training from Nurse Dawn, played by Alex Borstein.
No, the incident reports need to be really, really specific.
Okay, what else should I put?
Well, for starters, it's not a feces, it's just feces.
But it wasn't a gang of them, it was just one piece.
But there's no singular form for feces.
This season, the gang is back at it, dealing with death, diapers, and language that goes beyond scatological. When I talked with Niecy Nash earlier this week, I asked her if she ever looks at a script and says, are we really going there?
Season one, maybe. But after we came back for season two, we were like, is that all you got? You know, we deal with everything from the uttermost to the guttermost.
Exactly. Well, it's really fun to watch you all. And I was surprised to read that you initially auditioned for a different part on this show.
Yeah, you know, I actually auditioned for Nurse Dawn Forchette, which is the role that Alex Borstein plays.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at the callback that I said, can I read for this other character? And the producer said, no, you cannot. And I just started to talk about this character. Originally, her name wasn't even Dee Dee. I just started to talk about how much I loved her and the things that I thought were so subtle and so interesting. And so they said, well, if you love it that much, we'll let you read.
Well, that certainly is a case for speaking up.
Oh, yeah.
That's great. Do you ever talk to people who work in elder care, who perhaps have seen the show? And I would imagine that if you have, that for them, this show may be all too real.
Yes, I have. And some of the things we experience, I'm told, it's very realistic. And that is exactly the way it goes down. You know, I know I used to sometimes meet cops when I played Rainisha Williams on Reno 911,
right.
And I would cringe. I'm like, oh, my God, these people are going to think we're making a mockery of them. And then they would be like, yo, way to go. I love that show. So I'm happy that with this particular job, the real nurses are saying, you got it right.
You know, one of the great things about this show is the acting of the elderly women who are getting care in this hospital wing. And most of them don't even have lines, but they just have the most incredible facial expressions.
Didn't we get good faces?
You got great faces. They're just wonderful.
Yeah, they really, the casting really does a beautiful job at making sure we get the right women in those beds.
Niecy, this is one of several series recently where most of the primary characters are women. You know, you have Orange is the New Black, Girls. Any thoughts on the progress women are making in Hollywood?
Well, I think that getting on goes a step further because we're not young girls. We're middle-aged women working with women who are older than we are under what I like to call the worst lighting God ever created. And we have no makeup, no glamorous hair, no Spanx. And I'm grateful that there is an opportunity for women who are seasoned in this business to still show up and play really great characters.
You also have a recurring role on the Mindy Project. How did that come about?
That was a phone call. So interesting. You know, the producers of the Mindy Project were fans of Getting On. Which is the same thing that happened to me with the film that I have coming out on Christmas Day called Selma.
Right.
So Getting On is a gift that keeps on giving.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's talk a little bit about your role in Selma. You play Richie Jean Jackson, the civil rights leader who famously opened up her home to planners of the Selma to Montgomery March. This is a very different role for you from the comedy that you're well known for. What was the experience like for you?
It was the most amazing experience on a film I've ever had. It's always interesting when you play real people. But two, we're, you know, experiencing these landmarks and these different places, so much history. And I'm so happy that I'm at a place in my life where my fans can see me do other things. Because in my mind's eye, I never wanted to be funny. Comedy was not rewarded in my family. I got in trouble because I had talks too much on my report card. Why you in there talking? I was telling jokes, you know. So it was always stop it, sit down, stop acting up. That girl is so silly. So I didn't even know comedy was a gift. But every time I went in to audition for a serious role, the casting director would say, you are so funny. And I would get offended. And then when I tapped into the truth of how God made me, that's when I began to work. But that work was all big and broad and over the top and extra. And it wasn't until this time in my life right now where I'm actually doing the work that I feel like I was created to do.
Niecy Nash plays Nurse Dee Dee on the HBO series Getting On. Her new book is called It's Hard to Fight Naked, and she will be seen this Christmas in the film Selma. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And for the week ending November 23rd, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan, and Denise Guerra. Our intern is Chloe Persinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Marcia Caldwell. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Tess Vigeland. We will be back next week. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. And thanks for listening.